Okay, what I want to do is just give a brief, a general introduction to the theme, and then the other speakers will go into a number of the things that I will talk about in much more detail. What I want to start with is the recent World Development Reports just published by the World Bank, which seems to contradict some of the perceptions in the ISTAT assessment, because the World Bank now concludes that agriculture must be given a much more prominent place in the development agenda. So they've taken a bit of a 180 degree turn in their own policy over the last years. And because it has three major functions for development, it's the lead sector for economic growth in agriculture-based countries. It is a source of livelihood and of food security and poverty reduction. And it's also a better way for managing natural resources. And so if we look at where the poor live in the world, it's basically sub-Saharan Africa and even much more so in South and East Asia. So it's sometimes forgotten that about two-thirds of the world's poor live in Asia. And that includes rural, landless poor, and urban poor. And most of those actually eat rice every day, and 90% of the rice that we are interested in is grown in this part of the world. So our job in rice research is twofold. One is to provide sustainable livelihoods and employment for the rural population. In those areas where this is still the major economic force, and provide cheap rice supplies for the urban poor, which is an extremely important function, and we'll come back to that in a few minutes. So because of this, it is pretty clear that rice is central to achieving Millennium Development Goals, particularly those aimed at poverty, human health, and the nutrition part particularly, and the environment. Particularly in Asia, but also increasingly so in sub-Saharan Africa. So Andy alluded already to this. We have a need to produce 10% more rice by the year 2015. But as you can see, because of the changing demographics and also changing patterns in food consumption, the projected rice demand increases very widely. In East Asia, through the economic development, we actually expect a slight decline, and also the slowing down of the population growth. In Southeast Asia, it's pretty much close to the average that we expect. But if you look at Africa, this is going to be one of the major growth markets for rice demand. And we'll come back to that at the end. But 10% over a 10-year period since 2005 translates into an annual yield growth, or production growth, if you wish, if we assume that there isn't much growth in rice area, it's mostly yield-based anyway, of about 1% a year. How easy is it to achieve this? If you just look at the trends in some of the major rice-growing regions of the world, we see that we had, for long periods after the Green Revolution, basically annual growth rates in rice yields that were around or slightly above the growth rates in population. But in recent years, in the last 10 years here in South Asia, we are below that. In some years we get close to it again, but we've had major years where we even now go below or approach the 1% rate. In Southeast Asia, the trend has been downward even more, and in recent years we've been consistently below 1% yield increases per year. So we are quite a bit away from the population growth rate. And gets even worse in East Asia, which is primarily China, where we had years of negative growth. There are different reasons for this, and I'll come back at the very end of this, but this is concerning. If we are not capable of revitalizing yield growth, even though population growth is declining, we are not keeping pace with that. So it has already in recent years led to some dramatic changes on the world market, though we see an increase in rice prices here. This is the Global Rice Price Index. And so basically, if we take 2003 at about 100% baseline, so it's increased by about 30% since then, just in the last few years, we see an increase in net trade. In some countries, we have seen dramatic rises of the retail prices. Indonesia, probably the most dramatic one. And look at where the scale starts. This is just since January 2005. Rice prices have gone up from about 3,000 rupees per kilo to now more almost 5,000. There's other specific reasons in Indonesia, because the government restricts rice imports, but you can imagine that this has a tremendous impact on those parts of the population that rely on rice as a staple food. And we see world food aid affected by rising rice prices already. If you just look at the rapid decline in rice as food aid deliveries in recent years. So again, it is the poorest of the poor who are affected by increasing prices. And this is one of our main challenges that we need to tackle. And we tackle this through both improving intensive and rain-fed lowland rice systems. So I'll start with a few remarks on intensive irrigated systems, which we generally define as systems which have adequate water control. And those occupy about 79, 80 million hectares of harvested rice area, and so they account for about half of the world harvest area, but 75% of the production. So each hectare of irrigated rice land feeds more than 30 people. And so the primary function is provision of food for the food surplus for the urban population, as well as the livelihood of the farmers. But what is often forgotten is that these irrigated intensive systems have extremely unique features that translate into a very wide range of ecosystem services. They are extremely important for erosion and flood control, water purification, biodiversity, disease regulation, climate regulation, so particularly temperature buffering around major cities. But also they have recreational value, and in Asia they're part of the overall culture. Most of these functions at this point in time have no economic value for the farmers who preserve these systems. So one of our challenges in the future is also, whenever we talk about intensifying or diversifying these systems, can we maintain these functions? Can we put an economic value on those ecosystem services that rice farmers provide to the society as a whole? So the key challenge for the irrigated systems is really urbanization and water. And you can see that both in Asia and in Africa, that we expect a huge increase of the urban population. In some countries, we already started to see a decline of the rural population. And so they want affordable rice supplies. And this needs to be accomplished with less water, less land, and less labor. This is the principal challenge that we face. In some countries, more dramatic than in others, but overall, these are the trends that we need to worry about. So we think that there are a number of major targets for irrigated rice systems improvements. I think the primary one that we are really concerned about most with is that we are in an urgent need to revitalize yield growth, and at the same time, through that, improve income and also nutrition and the nutritional value of rice. So this lends itself to what we increasingly call an ecological intensification approach, which starts with still a tremendous need to invest more into breeding and both improving inbreds and hybrids. We still have to exploit whatever is possible in terms of increasing yield potential. We have not made much progress on that in the recent few decades, but I think there are still a few opportunities left to at least look at. we have a lot of new opportunities coming out of the genomics and molecular research that hopefully will translate into better approaches for more targeted abiotic and biotic stress tolerance breeding. And the whole area of grain and nutritional quality has become in recent years one of the major targets for germplasm improvement. I think along with this, we need to make sure that rice farmers in Asia have access to high quality seed. And I think hybrids in particular can play a major role also in terms of improving the high quality seed supply. We really are interested in increasing input efficiency at high yield levels. It is easy to achieve high input efficiency at low yield levels. The challenge is to learn how to do this at high yield levels, and that particularly increase water productivity and nutrient use efficiency. We are increasingly interested in landscape level approaches for natural pest control and other ecosystem services. We need to reduce post-harvest losses, and these ecologically intensified systems can also, I believe, make a major contribution to mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. Along with this, we have an increasing need to develop technologies and knowledge for sustainable management of diversifying rice systems, adapt to climate change and extreme weather, which we already face in many parts of Asia, and Dr. Kondo will talk about these issues a little bit more. And then we need a couple of pie in the sky activities, and probably from Erie's point of view, the most important one at this point is the C4 photosynthesis project, trying to increase the yield potential of rice by a large margin. Whether this will succeed and how long it will take to get there is absolutely unclear at this point in time. So one question that is often being asked is, are yield gaps exploited? Are we reaching technological limits? I don't believe that. I think, as I indicated before, yields need to increase at about 1% per year. And so for irrigated rice systems, we need to get to about 6.5 to 7 tons by the year 2030. At present, these systems yield 5.4 tons, which, based on our knowledge of the climatic and genetic yield potential of these environments, represents about 60%, 65% of this yield potential on average. There are places where farmers harvest already 80%. There are many places where it's only 50%. But what I firmly believe is, if you just look at this and assume that you can, usually with better management, target yields that are in the 70, 75, up to 80% of the yield potential range, we still have exploitable yield gaps that are typically 1 to 2 tons per hectare in some areas, even more. So I do not believe that we have exhausted what can be achieved with improved crop resource and crop and resource management technologies. So, and Roland Borisch later will talk about some of the efforts that we have in that direction. Diversification is of increasing importance for particularly Asia, and I'm just showing one example here that we're working on right now as part of our strategic assessment for the potential for rice maize systems in Asia to introduce new crops into continuous rice systems that are primarily designed to meet the increasing demands of the livestock industry for maize. So in Anyang in the Mekong Delta, the typical cropping system is a double cropping rice system, which produces, if we were able to achieve about 80% of the yield potential, about 15 tons of grain a year. Some farmers try triple cropping, so that gets up to 20 tons, but often they never even get close to this because this causes all kind of pest problems, particularly brown planthopper and viruses. Now we have various options to intensify and diversify these systems, and you can see them here. We introduce a maize crop in the dry season or in the early wet season, or we have even two maize crops in the dry season and early wet season. So potentially, these types of measures can raise the system level productivity to more than 20, even up to 25 tons per hectare. This is possible biophysically,
but requires a change in management, and also it requires a change in how we particularly do tillage and residue management to avoid depletion or degrading of the soil. And the number one problem that we see as soon as we diversify continuous rice systems, we lose soil organic matter. This is from a long-term experiment that Roland Burisch is conducting at Erie, where we compare a rice-rice system with a rice-maize system since 1993. And as you can see, over this 13-year period here in the rice-rice system, we have actually had a slight increase or no change in soil organic matter. As soon as we start bringing in an upland crop into the system, we've lost over this period close to 25% of the soil organic carbon. So to avoid this, we need different ways of managing these systems, and in this particular case, we believe it has to go towards reducing tillage in the upland crop phase. And residue retention did not prevent the loss of soil carbon in the system. So these are the kind of challenges that we face when it comes to diversification of intensive systems. Whenever there's inadequate water control, we talk about rain-fed lowland and upland systems, which cover another 50% of the rice area and produce about 25%. And each hectare in these environments, on average, feeds 13 people of land. The big challenge that we have there is really to provide enough food and income for rural livelihoods. And so what we need to address as the highest priority issues are abiotic stresses at this point in time. Drought, uncontrolled flooding that basically kills rice plants, and salinity. And Dave McKill, I think, will talk about these issues a lot more because we believe we have some unique breeding opportunities that are emerging or have already established themselves as very promising technologies. So I'm just showing one example here, which is probably the most famous one right now in recent years, the introduction of the SUB1 submergence tolerance gene into a number of what we call mega varieties of rice that are widely grown in these rain-fed lowland areas in Asia. So this is an experimented area where the field was flooded, submerged these rice plants for 17 days, and after that, you can see the ones which had the SUB1 tolerance gene are doing just fine, whereas the same varieties without that gene have essentially completely disappeared. So huge potential through precision breeding approaches on abiotic stresses, at least for those stresses where we have already found large QTLs, to increase the attainable yield potential in these marginal environments. And along with this, these environments also lend themselves to more investments into crop and resource management technologies. So this is a study from drought-tolerant varieties. So this is the current farmer's practice. If we just come in with improved management, we can make a small increase in yields. If we improve just the variety, replace it with a more drought-tolerant one, we already get almost a ton of yield increase. If we combine it with improved resource management, so more fertilizers and other inputs, in this particular case, the yield increases are 1.5 to almost 2 tons. So breeding sets the stage for investments into those other technologies, and I think we have some exciting opportunities right now. A word about Africa. Right now, rice production in Africa is still relatively small. 8.5 million hectares, and the yields are extremely low, primarily because most of the rice, the yellow and the red dots, is rain-fed lowland and upland areas. There's some irrigated rice in the Western African part and in Madagascar, but the bulk of the rice is really rain-fed systems. But rice has become the fastest growing food crop in Africa. Some people don't really appreciate this. And right now, Africa imports nearly 50% of its rice, more than 6 million tons a year, which costs about $1.5 billion. So there is huge further increases in rice demand expected. And there is, I think, little potential to meet those purely from imports only. Rice markets are tight, rice is expensive. And so expansion of rice area in Africa is considered as one target. There's a fair amount of land climatically and biophysically suitable for rice, but it will require investments and will require tolerant varieties that can cope with abiotic stresses in these environments. It'll require investments into infrastructure and supply chains. So what we think are key challenges for the rice in sub-Saharan Africa is really to reverse the reliance on a relatively volatile global rice market in situations where some countries are restricting exports right now in Asia because they have to secure their own food supplies. Will not make it easier for Africa to find rice on the market. There is a large potential, I believe, to increase yields in existing rice lands, but also to develop some of the lowlands that aren't really being used for rice at this point. So abiotic stresses, establishing a functioning seed sector, accessing inputs and resource-efficient crop and natural resource management technologies, better post-harvest technologies and capacity building are probably the major issues that Africa needs to address and that we and others are beginning to address in a much larger scale already right now. Now, in the past, we've been extremely successful to increase rice yields over time. And there are this is the average world rice yield since 1960 until 2006. And at the bottom, I've tried to indicate the major targets in breeding that came along during different periods of time, and also some of the changes in breeding technologies that have taken place. Above that, the changes in crop and resource management that were triggered by the availability of improved germplasm or by the need to address new issues that were created by the intensification of rice systems, particularly in Asia. What is concerning is that in the last 5 years, we've been consistently below the long-term trend line of a 53 kilogram grain per hectare yield increase that we've had for the last 40-45 years. And the question arises whether this is already a reflection of declining investments in research and development in agriculture and also in rice research. We've had periods like this, you can see in the early 1970s, which also coincided with huge increases in the world rice prices. Well, we were able to turn them around during the 1980s. Until the early mid-1990s because investments were made in research. Investments started to decline since the early 1990s, and maybe what we see now here is part of the decline already. This is from the recent World Development Report. It is very clear that even though many countries rely on agriculture for a large percentage of their GDP, they're spending only a fraction of what developed countries, urbanized countries, spend on agriculture and agricultural research and development. And donor support has certainly not helped us either, because even though rural poverty remains at levels of 80%, the overseas development assistance, which used to be about 10% going to agriculture just 15 years ago, has declined to less than 4% now. So if we don't reverse this trend, then I think the world will see crises which we did not expect to see again for a long time. So thank you.